Imagine you are standing in a vast, noisy marketplace. Thousands of people are shouting at once. Some want lower food prices. Some want better roads. Some want the river cleaned up. Some want a new school for their children. The noise is overwhelming, and no single voice can be heard above the rest. Now imagine that someone begins organizing these voices into groups. People with similar concerns gather together. They choose a spokesperson. They agree on a list of demands. Suddenly, the chaos becomes something a government can actually respond to. That, in its simplest form, is what a political party does. A political party is an organized group of people who share similar beliefs about how society should be run. They work together to win elections and use government power to put their ideas into practice. Political parties are among the most important and most criticized institutions in any democracy. Understanding them means understanding how ordinary citizens connect to the enormous machinery of government. Let us begin at the beginning, with a story that reveals just how quickly parties become necessary, even when the most powerful people in the room do not want them. When the United States was founded in the late 1700s, its leaders were deeply suspicious of political parties. They called them factions, meaning groups of people pursuing their own selfish interests at the expense of the nation as a whole. George Washington, the first president of the United States, gave a famous speech when he left office in 1796. In that speech, known as his farewell address, he warned Americans about what he called the baneful effects of the spirit of party. The word baneful means harmful or poisonous. Washington believed that parties would divide the nation and poison its politics. What happened next is both ironic and deeply instructive. Within just 10 years of Washington's warning, two clear political parties had already formed in America. One was the Federalists, who wanted a strong central government. The other was the Democratic Republicans, who wanted more power kept with individual states. Washington himself, though he claimed to be above parties, was seen as aligned with the Federalists. Even the man warning against parties could not escape them. This tells us something important. Political parties do not form because people are selfish or foolish. They form because when large groups of people need to make collective decisions, they naturally organize around shared ideas. Parties are not a disease that infects democracy. In many ways, they are democracy doing exactly what it is supposed to do. Now let us look more closely at what a political party actually is from the inside. A political scientist named V.O. Key Jr., who studied American politics in the middle of the 20th century, gave us a very useful way of thinking about this. He said that every political party is really three things at once, and understanding all three helps us see how parties actually work. The first part is what Key called the party in the electorate. The word electorate simply means all the people who are eligible to vote. The party in the electorate is made up of ordinary citizens who feel some loyalty or connection to a particular party. They are not necessarily paid members. They may not attend meetings or donate money, but when election day comes, they reliably vote for that party. In Britain, for example, millions of working-class people historically felt a deep loyalty to the Labour Party, even if they never attended a single party meeting in their lives. Their identity and the party's identity were intertwined. This is the emotional and social foundation that every party needs to survive. The second part is the party as an organization. Think of this as the engine room of the party. This is the formal structure, the headquarters, the paid staff, the volunteer coordinators, the fundraisers, and the strategists. This part of the party does the unglamorous but essential work. It recruits candidates to run for office. It organizes conventions, which are large gatherings where the party makes important decisions about its direction and chooses its leaders. It raises money for election campaigns. It designs the messages that will appear on posters and television advertisements. It sends people door to door to encourage supporters to actually go and vote. Without this organizational machine, the shared feelings of millions of supporters would never translate into political power. In the United States, each major party has what is called a national committee. The Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee are the central organizations that coordinate their respective parties at the national level. Below these are state committees, and below those are local organizations that work at the level of individual neighborhoods or voting districts. This pyramid structure means that a single party stretches from the national government all the way down to your street. The third part key identified is the party in government. This refers to the elected officials and appointed leaders who actually hold power and make decisions. These are the presidents, prime ministers, members of parliament, and local councillors who belong to the party. Their job is to take the ideas in the party's platform, which is the official list of policies the party promises to pursue, and turn those ideas into actual laws and government programs. Here is an interesting tension worth understanding. These three parts of a party do not always agree with each other. Imagine a political party whose activists, the most passionate and committed members of its organization, want a bold and radical policy on climate change. The elected politicians in the same party, however, know that such a radical policy might anger voters in certain important regions. The politicians want to adopt a more moderate position. Meanwhile, the millions of ordinary supporters in the electorate may be somewhere in the middle. The party is simultaneously being pulled in three different directions by its own components. Managing these tensions is one of the most difficult jobs in politics. Now let us turn to the ideas that hold parties together. Political scientists use the word ideology to describe a connected set of beliefs about how society should be organized and what the government should do. An ideology is like a map. It does not show you every single path, but it gives you a general direction and a way of reading the landscape. When a new problem arises, a party uses its ideology to figure out what kind of solution fits with its values. The most widely used tool for describing political ideologies is something called the left-right spectrum. The word spectrum here means a scale or range, like the spectrum of colors in a rainbow. On one end is the political left, and on the other end is the political right. Parties and politicians are placed somewhere along this line depending on their beliefs. Here is something fascinating about where this language comes from. During the French Revolution in the late 1700s, the French National Assembly was a parliament trying to redesign the entire French government. Members who sat on the left side of the chamber tended to support radical change and popular power. Members who sat on the right side tended to support the king and traditional institutions. From the simple accident of seating arrangements, we inherited the entire vocabulary of left and right that still shapes how we talk about politics today. So, what does left mean in politics? Broadly speaking, parties on the left tend to believe that the government should play an active role in reducing inequality and ensuring that everyone has their basic needs met. They tend to support programs like public healthcare, which means the government pays for medical treatment so that poor people receive the same care as rich people. They support strong labor unions, which are organizations that protect workers' rights. They tend to favor higher taxes on wealthy people and corporations to fund these programs. They often emphasize collective well-being, the idea that what happens to the weakest member of society matters to everyone. What does right mean in politics? Broadly speaking, parties on the right tend to believe that individual freedom and personal responsibility are more important than government intervention. They tend to favor lower taxes, arguing that people should keep more of what they earn and spend it as they choose. They support free markets, meaning economies where businesses operate with little government interference. They often argue that government programs, however well-intentioned, make people dependent and reduce overall prosperity. They tend to place great importance on tradition, order, and national security. A good way to make this concrete is to think about healthcare. Imagine a country is debating whether to create a national health service where the government pays for everyone's medical care. A left-wing party would likely strongly support this idea, arguing that healthcare is a right and that no one should suffer or die because they cannot afford a doctor. A right-wing party would likely oppose it, arguing that it would cost too much in taxes, that the government would run it inefficiently, and that people should be free to choose and pay for their own healthcare. Both positions reflect genuine values, and the debate between them is at the heart of politics in most democratic countries. However, the left-right spectrum has real limitations. It flattens a complicated world into a single straight line. Consider libertarianism, which is a political philosophy that combines elements from both sides. Libertarians believe strongly in free markets and low taxes, which sounds like the right, but they also strongly oppose government interference in people's personal lives, supporting, for example, the legalization of drugs or same-sex marriage, which tends to align with the left. Where does libertarianism go on the spectrum? It does not fit neatly, and that tells us that the spectrum is a useful simplification, not a perfect description of reality. Another ideology that defies easy placement is populism. Populism is not really a detailed policy program. It is more of a style or approach to politics. A populist leader presents politics as a battle between the ordinary people and a corrupt, out-of-touch elite. Populism can appear on both the left and the right. A left-wing populist might argue that ordinary workers are being exploited by greedy corporations and wealthy bankers. A right-wing populist might argue that ordinary citizens are being ignored by liberal politicians, journalists, and academics who think they know better. What both share is the idea that a genuine, pure people have been betrayed by a dishonest elite. This message has proven powerfully appealing in many countries in recent decades, from the United States under Donald Trump to Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. Ideologies are not fixed forever. They evolve, sometimes dramatically. Political scientists use the term political realignment to describe a major shift in which groups of voters support which party, often driven by a crisis or a great historical change. This is a fascinating phenomenon. In the United States, for example, the Democratic Party was the dominant party of the American South for nearly a century after the Civil War. Southern white voters supported Democrats because Republicans had been the party of Abraham Lincoln, who had led the Union against the Confederacy. But during the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, the Democratic Party, under President Lyndon Johnson, championed legislation that gave Black Americans equal rights. Many white Southern voters felt betrayed and began moving toward the Republican Party. Over the following decades, the political map of the United States was fundamentally redrawn. A party's ideology and voter base are never completely permanent. Let us now step inside the government and see what parties actually do once they have won elections. Their role is far more central to governance than most people realize. In almost every Democratic legislature, the party that wins the most seats gains enormous power to control what actually happens. In the United States House of Representatives, the majority party, meaning the party with more than half the seats, chooses the Speaker of the House. The Speaker is one of the most powerful politicians in the country, controlling which proposed laws even get discussed and voted on. Committee chairs, who lead the smaller groups of legislators that examine and write the details of laws, are also members of the majority party. This means that even if the minority party has excellent ideas, the majority party can simply ignore them by never allowing a vote. In parliamentary systems, which are used in countries like the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and India, the connection between party and government is even more direct. In a parliamentary system, voters elect members of parliament, and the leader of the party that wins the most seats automatically becomes the head of government, called the prime minister. The prime minister then appoints the cabinet, which is the group of senior ministers who run the major government departments. This means that the entire executive power of government, the power to actually run the country day-to-day, comes directly from the party's victory in elections. Lose the election, lose the government. This leads to one of the most important concepts in understanding how parties govern, the coalition government. Imagine a parliament with 100 seats. Party A wins 40 seats. Party B wins 30 seats. Party C wins 20 seats. Party D wins 10 seats. No party has a majority, meaning more than 50 seats, so no single party can govern alone. What happens? Parties must negotiate. In this situation, party A might approach party C and offer them two cabinet positions and a promise to support their most important policy if party C agrees to support party A in parliament. If they agree, they form a coalition government, a government run by two or more parties working together. Coalition governments are common in countries like Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Israel. They require constant compromise and negotiation. The smaller party in a coalition can sometimes have an influence far greater than its size suggests, because its votes are needed to keep the government in power. This can frustrate supporters of the larger party who feel their mandate is being diluted. But it can also mean that a wider range of citizens see their views reflected in government. In presidential systems like the United States, a different problem can arise. Because the president is elected separately from the legislature, it is entirely possible for one party to control the presidency while the other party controls Congress. This situation is called divided government. When divided government occurs, the two parties must cooperate to pass any laws because the president can block legislation with a veto, the power to refuse to sign a bill into law, and Congress can block the president's agenda by refusing to vote for his or her proposals. When the parties are deeply hostile to each other, divided government can lead to gridlock, a situation where nothing gets done because neither side will compromise. Citizens may feel frustrated that the government seems paralyzed, even though elected officials are working every day. One of the most vital functions of political parties in governments is what political scientists call accountability. Accountability is the idea that those who hold power must answer to those over whom they hold it. Parties create a clear mechanism for accountability in democracies. When an election arrives, voters can look at the record of the governing party. Has unemployment gone up or down? Is the country at war or at peace? Are people better off than they were 4 or 5 years ago? If they are satisfied, they can reward the governing party with another term. If they are dissatisfied, they can vote for the opposition party and remove the current government from power. This mechanism, sometimes described colloquially as throwing the rascals out, is one of the great simplifying features of party democracy. You do not need to evaluate every individual politician. You can simply decide whether the party in power has done a good job. Now let us zoom out and look at the broader landscape of party systems around the world. Because not all countries organize their political competition in the same way, some countries have a two-party system, where two major parties dominate and take turns in government. The United States is the clearest example, with the Democratic Party and the Republican Party controlling almost all national offices for over a century and a half. The United Kingdom has traditionally been dominated by the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, though smaller parties have gained ground in recent decades. Two-party systems tend to emerge in countries that use a voting method called first-past-the-post, where the candidate who gets the most votes in a single district wins the seat, even if they do not get a majority. This system punishes smaller parties. A party that wins 20% of the vote nationwide but does not come first in any individual district might win 0 seats. The mathematical logic of this system, famously described by the political scientist Maurice Duverger and known as Duverger's Law, pushes political competition toward two dominant parties. Many other countries have multi-party systems, where several parties compete and coalition governments are the norm rather than the exception. These countries typically use proportional representation as their voting system. Proportional representation means that if a party wins 20% of the national vote, it gets approximately 20% of the seats in parliament. This system allows smaller parties to survive and grow because their votes are not wasted. Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands, and many other European democracies use forms of proportional representation and have vibrant multi-party systems with parties representing a wide range of perspectives. Then there is a third type, the one-party system. In a one-party state, a single party controls all political power. Other parties may technically be allowed to exist, but they have no real chance of winning. The government uses its power to ensure that the ruling party remains dominant. China is governed by the Chinese Communist Party, which has held power since 1949. North Korea is another example. In these systems, the party's role is fundamentally different from its role in a democracy. It does not compete for votes. Instead, it functions as the organizing structure of the entire state, controlling the government, the military, the media, and often the economy. Citizens are sometimes required to be members of party organizations. The party's goal is not to win elections but to maintain order, implement its ideology, and reproduce its power across generations. Understanding these different types helps us see that the word party can mean very different things in different contexts. A party in Sweden negotiating over healthcare policy in a coalition government is a fundamentally different kind of institution from the Communist Party of China administering a nation of 1.4 billion people. No honest lesson about political parties would be complete without addressing the serious criticisms they face. These are not minor quibbles. They are deep challenges to the health of democracy itself. The first criticism concerns polarization. Polarization means the process by which two sides move further and further apart, becoming more extreme and less willing to compromise. In the United States, surveys and voting records show that over the past few decades, the Democratic and Republican parties have moved steadily further from the center. A moderate Republican from the 1970s might hold positions closer to a mainstream Democrat of today than to a modern Republican. This distance makes compromise extremely difficult. Legislators who try to work with the other side risk being seen as traitors by their own party's base. The result can be gridlock, government shutdowns, and a political culture dominated by hostility rather than problem solving. Many citizens find this deeply frustrating and demoralizing. The second criticism involves money. Running a modern political campaign is extraordinarily expensive. Television advertisements, digital marketing, professional staff, and voter outreach all cost enormous sums. Parties and candidates must raise this money somewhere, and much of it comes from wealthy individuals and large corporations. Critics argue that this financial dependence makes parties more responsive to their donors than to ordinary voters. A working-class voter's concerns may be systematically ignored because addressing them would require policies that displease the major donors who fund the party's campaigns. This criticism is made about parties across the political spectrum, not just one side. A third challenge is what scholars call delinement, which means the weakening of voters' attachment to political parties. In many democracies, the number of voters who identify strongly with a party has been declining for decades. More people call themselves independents, meaning they do not consistently support one party. They vote based on individual candidates or specific issues rather than party loyalty. This is partly driven by changes in society. People are better educated and have access to far more information through the internet and social media. They feel less need to rely on a party label to guide their political thinking. The rise of candidate-centered campaigns, where the individual personality of a politician matters more than their party, has also reduced the power of parties as organizations. Some scholars argue this is healthy, suggesting a more sophisticated electorate. Others argue it makes politics less stable and harder to predict. A fourth concern is that parties can actually distort representation rather than improve it. A two-party system forces complex, nuanced views into one of two boxes. A voter might agree with the Republican Party on economic policy but agree with the Democratic Party on social issues. They are forced to choose the package that best fits them, rather than the combination of policies they actually believe in. Parties also sometimes enforce internal discipline that silences individual politicians who disagree with the official party line, reducing the diversity of voices in government. And parties have historically been slow to include women, minority ethnic groups, and other underrepresented communities in positions of leadership, meaning that the people making decisions may not reflect the full diversity of the society they govern. These criticisms are real and serious. Yet even the most passionate critics of political parties rarely argue that we should simply abolish them. The alternative, hundreds of individual politicians each acting alone with no organizational structure, would likely produce even more chaos and even less accountability. Parties, frustrating as they are, solve fundamental problems of coordination and representation that democracy cannot do without. There is a powerful analogy here. Think of a political party like a large family. Families can be dysfunctional. They can have arguments that never get resolved. Some members can behave selfishly. Powerful relatives can dominate quieter ones. But families also provide structure, identity, and collective strength that individuals on their own simply cannot match. You might sometimes wish your family were different. But the answer is rarely to have no family at all. The answer is to work to make it better. Let us bring together the key ideas of this lesson. We began with the paradox that even the founders who most feared political parties found them indispensable within a generation. That tells us something deep. Parties emerge naturally from the needs of democratic politics. They turn the scattered opinions of millions of citizens into organized, actionable political programs. We learned to think of a party as three things at once. It is the millions of ordinary supporters who feel loyalty to it, the formal organizational machine that does the hard work of elections and strategy, and the elected officials who carry the party's program into government. These three components are always in some degree of tension with each other. We explored ideology, the maps of values and beliefs that give parties their direction. The left-right spectrum, born from the seating arrangements of the French Revolution, remains our most common tool for describing these differences. Even though it simplifies a much more complex reality, parties on the left generally emphasize equality and collective welfare, while parties on the right generally emphasize individual freedom and limited government. Ideologies like libertarianism and populism remind us that the real political world always exceeds any simple model we create to describe it. We saw how parties organize government, controlling legislatures, forming executives, and providing the mechanism of accountability through which voters can reward or punish those in power. We distinguished between parliamentary systems, where party victory directly determines who governs, and presidential systems, where divided government can produce gridlock. We compared two-party systems, multi-party systems, and one-party systems, understanding how different voting rules and political cultures produce very different landscapes of party competition. And we took seriously the criticisms, polarization that makes compromise impossible, the distorting influence of money, the weakening of party loyalty among voters, and the ways parties can simplify and exclude rather than represent. Political parties are not perfect institutions. They have never been, but they remain the primary mechanism through which citizens and democracies organize their collective will, hold their governments to account, and compete for the power to shape the future. Understanding how they work, what they believe, and why they behave as they do is not merely an academic exercise. It is one of the essential skills of democratic citizenship.